brilliant man with lots of well-thought-out, practical ideas, and his personal hygiene is above reproach.
Oh, what a way to start out. Greg Kokel here at Standard Reason. And, of course, you can't tell that if my personal hygiene is above reproach when you're on radio. I guess if you really stink, it comes across. That'd be a very bad case. Greg Kokel, Stand to Reason, is the name of the show, and my goal is to defend classical Christianity and classical Christian values here. I do that every Sunday from 3 until 5, and I don't do that alone. We do this together. The phone number here, 1-800-227-5278. If you're in the 714 area code, the number 754-4150. That's local and direct. So you can call either number, and I'd be glad to talk to you about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. Since we're getting close to the election, we're just less than a month away, I want to say something about Prop 8. Now, Prop 8 is this Protect Marriage Act in California. So this is local politics in a sense, but as goes California, so goes the rest of the country. And if Prop 8 does not pass, then this bodes ill for the rest of the country in terms of the protection of marriage, and bodes ill for the rest of the country in general if marriage is not protected. The Protection of Marriage Act, Proposition 8, this is when the people get to vote, direct democracy generally, I think. It's not a good idea. Because it presumes the people know what's best, and that's rarely the case. And the reason I say that is not that they don't know what's best for them or what they like. It's kind of like the guy who says, I don't know much about art, but I know what I like. But those are often the wrong kinds of reasons to vote on something that has ramifications for the broader public good. Maybe we know what we like, but we don't always know what's supportive of the common good, what's best. And we're also very vulnerable to manipulation. And this is evident every time election season rolls around. You can see it on the advertisements. Now, I don't watch TV by and large, certainly not network TV. I don't see those kinds of ads characteristically, but we still get our things in the mail, and some of that stuff is grotesque. But the reason they put these things out, these grotesque appeals to voters that have little to do with the issue at hand, is because people are swayed by that. And when it comes to Prop 8, I think there's a similar problem. Prop 8 is an attempt to reverse what judges did in California a couple of months ago, and what I understand just happened in the state of Connecticut, in which they said the state constitution requires that same-sex couples get the same treatment with regards to the marriage laws as heterosexual couples. Now, it does strike me as a little bit odd that both state constitutions were in play for a long time. In the state of Connecticut, that was one of the original 13, right? So they go all the way back to the beginning, and no one saw this obvious meaning of that constitution. And even in liberal California, we didn't see this until recently, that this is what the constitution demands. So this is what you get when you get a living constitution. The thing is changing, or the meanings change as time changes. I've said before, the only thing living about the living constitution approach to lawmaking is the imagination of the lawmakers, or actually I should say the imagination of the judges in this particular case. In any event, the response to the judge's action a few months ago declaring that it was unconstitutional to deny marriage to same-sex couples was to pass a constitutional amendment that identified marriage specifically as being an institution between a man and a woman, and therefore a marriage license could not be given out to same-sex couples. Now, this same issue was addressed a number of years ago in the initiative process here, where the people vote directly, and it it passed with an overwhelming majority, but it wasn't a constitutional amendment. So since it was statute by the people, then the judges could overrule it. Now this is a constitutional amendment. Now, things have changed, though, in the state of California and around the country, and for a while, this didn't look like it was going to pass. Now things look better. So those who are in favor of this proposition have reason to hope. I want to point out something, though, that some people have missed, and I was a bit surprised to see on the Prop 8 literature, and that caused me to rethink something I've said in the past and actually now to think better of what I said before. So there's a sense in which I guess I'm saying I was wrong. Well, I wasn't completely wrong, but I was missing something that I now want to take into consideration when I adjust my point about same-sex marriages and things like domestic partnerships. Now, in the past, I have been against domestic partnerships. And the reason I have been against them is because, in my view, I wanted not to save a word, an eight-letter word like marriage. I wanted to save an institution. Now, if it turns out, because I think this institution, marriage, is a cornerstone to society, and there is a reason why the state should be involved in regulating and protecting this particular kind of relationship. That is because this relationship, long-term, monogamous, committed, heterosexual unions as a rule and as a group and by nature, and I would say by design, produce the next generation. And because that is unique about this kind of personal relationship, then the government has an interest in regulating it, restricting it, and protecting it. All other relationships, by and large, they don't care about. Do what you want. There's no reason for them to step in. Now, since I was interested in protecting that institution, I didn't want the institution given away under any name, under marriage, with same-sex marriage, or given away de facto, for all intents and purposes, under a different name, domestic partnerships. And so it seemed to me kind of a Pyrrhic victory, that is a costly victory, if we are able to save the name marriage for heterosexual couples, but turn out to give away the institution, that is, all the rights and privileges that befall heterosexual couples in that kind of union, to same-sex couples. So it turns out then the only distinction between the two relationships is a word, marriage versus domestic partnerships. And it seems to me when it gets to that point, we've lost the battle. And then I discovered something unusual here in the state in California, which I didn't know before, but I saw it on the Yes on 8 Protect Marriage promotional material. And that was that apparently in the state of California, according to Family Code, I think that symbol means paragraph. It's that little circle with funny lines coming off the top and bottom of it. That paragraph? That's legalese. Family Code, we'll call it paragraph 297.5, makes it very clear under California law that same-sex couples, quote, shall have the same rights, protections, and benefits, close quote, as heterosexual couples. I realize that in one sense, with regards to the law, in the state of California, at least, we've already lost. On my other way of thinking, we have already given everything up. There is no difference now, as far as the law is concerned, in the state of California, between same-sex unions under domestic partnerships and heterosexual unions under marriage laws. It's exactly the same. There's nothing different except for the word. marriage. Marriage applies, or marriage licenses apply to heterosexual couples, whereas domestic partnership, what would you call them, agreements, contracts, arrangements apply to same-sex couples. That's the difference. It's what's in a name. As Shakespeare famously said, a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. However, I'm rethinking my view a little bit because it occurred to me last week that maybe there is something in a name after all. I was invited to do a debate scheduled for tomorrow night, which now is not happening, as it turns out. It just didn't materialize, but we initially agreed to do a debate on this issue at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, big school up the coast, California Polytechnical Institute in San Luis Obispo. And so I said, sure, I'd be glad to do this. And I'm thinking in my mind, how am I going to position myself? I've got all kinds of notes about same-sex marriage, challenges and responses. You can find that on our website at str.org. I've got a piece I've written called When the Bride is a Groom, also at str.org. Lots of material there. I did a TV event, a closed-circuit TV event I told you about last week, about a week and a half ago. I got my notes for that. I got all this stuff that I could use in a debate, and suddenly I realized I don't need it. Because what is the person who is against Prop 8 going to argue? That same-sex couples don't have the right same liberties as heterosexual couples? Well, they can't argue that because no matter what state they're in, they have the same liberties. That is, they can do all the same things that heterosexual couples can do. They can celebrate a marriage of sorts. That is, they could get hitched. They can walk down the aisle in a church in many cases or a public venue and invite their friends and stand before someone and pledge their troth to each other until death do them part. They can go on a honeymoon. They can set up housekeeping. They can arrange to have common inheritance of common property. In many states, they can even adopt children. Not all, but many. In other words, they have exactly the same liberties as everybody else. No one's stopping them. And in fact, I think Americans, and especially Californians, are particularly accommodating. They have largely a live-and-let-live attitude, even those who believe that such unions are immoral. It isn't as if they're in any significant way pushing their morality on other people. They hold their moral view, that is, Christians by and large, evangelicals, hold, many of them, that same-sex unions and homosexuality itself are immoral. But there's no sense that they're pushing that on other people, unless you just simply think that holding one's moral ground on one's own moral opinion as it applies to other people is forcing your view on someone else. Of course, if that's the case, then everybody's forcing their view. So there's a tremendous amount of latitude there given people to exercise their liberty and pretty much do what they want in the privacy of their own bedrooms or homes or whatever. I mean, I've heard a lot of people in favor of same-sex marriage says, well, why shouldn't we let people do what they want? Well, they already can. You don't need the law to approve of that. They already can. So there are the same liberties. But there has been an issue of whether the couple, as a couple, has the same, I guess you could say simply put, rights, entitlements that befall them as a couple as befall a heterosexual couple through matrimony. You're right, there is difference. And I've always argued that it's a legitimate distinction because comparing the two couples is like apples and oranges. From the state's perspective, there is no policy reason why they ought to treat same-sex couples like heterosexual couples, because the only reason they mess with heterosexual couples is because long-term monogamous heterosexual relationships as a rule, as a group, by nature and by design, produce the next generation. and these other relationships don't. So the government just leaves hands off, which is what I thought people wanted to begin with, particularly homosexual people. Stay out of our lives. Now this is just the opposite. In any event, there is an argument that could be made that the government ought not extend the same rights to same-sex couples, as they do to heterosexual couples as couples. But that point, of course, no longer needs to be argued in the state of California. That point is moot. If you are in favor of Proposition 8, which defines marriage as between a man and a woman in the Constitution of California, as far as the state is concerned, men and women get married. Others might have partnerships, but men and women get married. Marriage is a male-female thing. If you are in favor of that, your job is really easy now. Because as in the past, no one could argue that same-sex couples didn't have the same liberties. They do. Always have. No one could stop them from doing whatever they wanted to do. Certainly in the state of California. And I only mention that because there are some states that have sodomy laws still on the books that they don't enforce, but not in California. Now they can no longer say they don't have the same rights because they do, according to Family Code paragraph 297.5. They have all the same rights, protections, benefits as anyone else. What are they clamoring for now? They're clamoring for a name. That's it. They're fighting for a name. That's it. Now, there's something attached to the name that they desperately want, and the thing attached to the name is not rights, not liberties, but respect. It's a way for the state, which is the people, to say there are no differences whatsoever between heterosexual relationships and same-sex relationships, and so then there can be no distinctions of any kind in any way in those relationships. Now, if you are somebody who is leaning against Proposition 8 because you read the bumper stickers and it said equality for all, well, that's already been resolved. If you're concerned about liberty for all, that's already been resolved. This is not at issue anymore. There is complete equality under the law of California and complete liberty to do what people want. That's not at issue. What is at issue is whether we as a country and here as a state are going to continue to make a distinction between, can I say, inconsequential with regards to law and culture, inconsequential consensual relationships, and an institution that is the cornerstone of civilization. When I say inconsequential consensual relationships like domestic partnerships, I'm not saying that any particular relationship is inconsequential to them. I'm saying it's inconsequential to the big scene. Whether or not there are domestic partnerships affirmed by law or not, or whether they are ever formed or not, is irrelevant to civilization. Civilization did just fine for thousands of years without those things. And if we never had them, civilization would still do just fine. Now we have them. People got something they were after. Okay, good for them. But they are inconsequential in the big picture with regards to culture, with regards to civilization. But marriage between a man and a woman is not inconsequential. It is not irrelevant. If we didn't have those kinds of relationships, then culture would disappear. That would be it. And therefore, it seems to me, and there's a lot of other reasons, by the way, I don't have time to get into, it's a good thing we keep these distinct, even if in name only. Because we are acknowledging that there is a relationship that is central to everything, and that is a unique relationship, and that is a relationship between a man and a woman in a long-term monogamous committed relationship, and there is no way any other relationship can match its significance to culture, society, and civilization. And for that reason alone, people are justified in distinguishing between these two relationships, even if the rights and liberties and privileges, protections, benefits are applied, at least in the state of California, equally to each party. All right, 1-800-227-5278 is the number, and if you're in the 714 area code, you can dial direct at 754-4150. This is Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kochel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
I feel heavenly grace descending on me for nothing I've done.
Greg Kochel back with you here at Stand to Reason, the place to get your brainwashed brain washed every weekend, Sundays 3 until 5. Who is this? Don't know. All right, I do know who's up first here. Joey in Minnesota. Let's go to Minnesota. Joey, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, glad to do so, Joey.
Well, I have kind of a more of a practical question for you, not so theological today.
All right.
It's about, we have a friend. She's a Christian, and she met a great guy who happens to be a professing non-Christian. He was very clear about that.
Uh-huh.
He sees all religions as basically the same kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my wife and some of the other girlfriends went and they went and talked with her and said, you know, they really kind of discouraged her. This might not be, if you're so attracted to them, but the spiritual part isn't there, and maybe it's something you should take concern. Well, mm-hmm. She decided to go ahead and date him anyway, and they've been dating for a while. And let's see. And so now we're kind of wondering, she's basically abandoned all of her Christian friends in pursuit of any, she'll basically hang out with people who, the way she sees it is that she thinks she'd be ruining her Christian witness if she broke up with him. And so
really?
we're trying to figure out how we haven't been in contact with her for a while. We tried to hang out, but she's just not really interested, it seems, in coming out. And we're wondering if we can get them to hang out or how should we approach the situation. And because the guy isn't a Christian.
Right.
Is this a huge concern or is this something that is just, are we looking into
it
too much?
Oh, gosh. Well, Joey, I have a lot to say about this. The simple answer to your last question is it is a huge concern.
Uh-huh. Okay.
It is very unfortunate that your friend is now looking at it in this kind of way. Notice the nature of her justification. She says it is basically, she's saying it is the spiritual thing to do to continue dating this non-Christian man.
Mm-hmm.
Because if I broke up, it would what? How did you put it? It would ruin my Christian witness. Well, my question is to her, and maybe I should say this first, Joey. I am really sympathetic to this problem, more so probably than people might think, because I know I'm not single now, but I was single for 48 years. And I know a little bit about being single and being a Christian, and especially for single Christian gals.
Mm-hmm.
My general impression, and I don't have anybody in mind in particular when I say this, but my general impression is that Christian guys are largely feminized. They are more feminized than the rank and file guy in culture, yet I think they are feminized too. And so this is not attractive to women. And because they are more feminized, I don't think they're aggressive in the right ways. And what ends up happening is on Fridays and Saturday nights, the Christian gals sit home. And they don't get hardly any attention. And so consequently, when a really nice non-Christian guy shows them some attention, they're easy pickings. And I understand the conflict and the pain and the difficulty and the loneliness and all of that that goes with it, okay? So on the emotional side of the ledger here, I'm with them. I faced the same thing for many years. However, although it's a little different because at least I was in a position where I could do something, I could take initiative, where by and large Christian women are not in that position. However, our lives, if we are followers of Christ and we want to maintain our Christian witness, as it were, in other words, live a life that brings honor to Christ, and honoring Christ is the substance of our Christian witness. Some people have the idea that my Christian witness is what other people think of me as a Christian. Okay, that's the dog, the tail wagging the dog. Because people didn't like Jesus, many of them didn't like, and Jesus said the same thing is going to happen to us. Sometimes no matter what we do right, people won't like us, and the only way people will like us is if we do wrong. In other words, we join them. Our Christian witness, maintaining our Christian witness means living, caring about what Jesus thinks about us, not what other people think about our Christianity. I think your friend is caring more about what other people think of Christianity, and she thinks, well, if I break up with him because of Christ, then he will think ill of me and of Christianity. And my response is, he may, but that's, he'd be thinking ill of Christianity for the wrong reasons. And you would be doing, the young lady would be doing what's right, that is honoring Christ by doing that thing. Incidentally, and I've talked to people on both sides of this equation. And in other words, people who did the wrong thing and it turned out good by the grace of God, people who did the wrong thing and it turned out unbelievably bad, people who did the right thing and it turned out bad for them in that other people didn't like them, and people who did the right thing and it turned out good for them in that other people liked them. So we can't automatically conclude that because we obey Christ, that the people that are watching us say goodbye to the relationship out of faithfulness to Christ are actually going to disrespect our Christianity. Sometimes this is the thing that causes them to take Christianity seriously, because they're looking at someone else who also does that. She is not taking her Christianity seriously. Now, she may be very offended when I tell her, when I say that.
Mm-hmm.
What does he know? I say, I know this. I know that you are doing something that is specifically prohibited in the Scripture. 2 Corinthians chapter 5. Is that it? I'm looking for it now. Well, I know the verse. I'm just trying to find it. It says, do not be unequally yoked with non-believers, mm-hmm. for what does light have in common with darkness? Mm-hmm. And what does Christ have in common with Satan? Here it is. It's chapter 6. What harmony has Christ with Belial? And I think that's another name for Satan. What has a believer in common with an unbeliever? Or what agreement has the temple of God with idols? And then it says, you know, be separate from them. And it quotes from the Old Testament. It's a very, very strong statement. You can't miss the point here. Mm-hmm. We are not allowed to be unequally yoked. And there are lots of characterizations of that. But certainly if you're dating someone for a longer period of time, what is this but unequally yoked? The idea here is two cattle kind of pulling from on the same plow, and the stronger one pulls the weaker one off the track. The yoking, and that's exactly what's happening here, because she's taking what, and I'm just trying to be straightforward here. I'm not trying to be mean, but she's taking what God calls sin, and she's calling it spirituality. So my question for her would be, what is your Christian? What does that mean, Christian witness? What is that? Is Christian witness what Jesus thinks of your life, or is Christian witness what other people think of your life? And if you're a follower of Christ, it should be the first, not the second. Because if it's the second fairly consistently, you're not a follower of Christ at all. You're following other people. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a reason why someone could come up with such a bizarre justification for her behavior. It's because she made some foolish choices early on. She started to get involved. She started to yoke up. And that began to change her perspective. And what ended up happening is the more she got yoked up, the more this other relationship began to pull her off the track. And it's easier to make these decisions early when there's very little at stake than to try to make them later when there's so much at stake, and oftentimes try and fail. Because there are times when believing women have married non-believing men. But that's by a sheer act of grace, God's grace, in spite of the Christian's unfaithfulness. I would suspect that more often than not, the opposite happens. This man never becomes a Christian, and he either pulls the woman completely away from Christ, or against odds, the woman stays related to Christ, and there is a significant and deeply painful chasm between her and her husband that will never be breached, because he does not share her spiritual life, and forever she will know for her whole life that the man that she loves most in this world will be under God's judgment for eternity, separated from her and from Christ. Now, this is not a pretty picture. It is better, it is far better to stay single than to do that. And I have talked to many women who have said, oh, I wish I hadn't made this mistake. By the way, that's the best case scenario if the person doesn't become a believer is this anguish, this inability to connect, and the knowledge that the husband is never going to – will not be eternally with God and with the wife, but will be under God's judgment. Worst case scenario is that he continues to follow his non-Christian leanings and lives more consistently with them, and then you have a terrible marriage. See, I think it's possible to have a good marriage that is stable and loving and still not have this other connection, which I think the Christian woman would long for and really miss if she has a genuine relationship with Christ. But it could turn out that the husband just keeps going and going and going. And I've had many occasions where I've talked to women just like that. And it was miserable for them. That's the ideas. That those are the concepts there in play as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. Your friend is in disobedience to Christ. It is not a spiritual thing to do. It's a non-spiritual thing to do. Her Christian witness is determined by how Christ sees her actions, not how other people see her actions. And this is probably going to have a bad ending. The problem is, she may be married before she finds this out. And it would have been smarter for her and those who are listening who are tempted to the same direction not to get connected in the first place so that your judgment is distorted in the way that your friend's has been distorted. I would ask her exactly what does she mean by Christian witness. How is her Christian witness going to be disrupted by breaking off with this guy? And then maybe make the point of what Christian witness is involved with, and that's pleasing Christ, not other people. And you might point out the 2 Corinthians passage, chapter 6, if she's at all inclined to care about what the Scripture has to say about her relationship. And I don't know your friend, but I would not be surprised if she doesn't care that much anymore. Mm-hmm. Too much is at stake emotionally for her. And so she has chosen up sides. It doesn't mean she's irredeemable or anything like that. It means she has made choices up until this point that now make it emotionally virtually impossible for her to change course. I don't know her, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's the case.
Well, I definitely agree. The point with how Christ views this, I've never heard it like that. That really makes sense. And my wife and we've only been married 5 years, and we have a group of 20-somethings, and we told them when they started dating, wow, you know, here are things we would really be careful about. And sure enough, they're like, oh, yeah. Well, within 2 weeks, we lost all sight of them. And we said, hey, you know, if you're at least seeking another Christian community or something, that would be great. But as far as we know, I think they've abandoned most Christian contact altogether.
Yeah, and probably I wouldn't be surprised in situations like this. People who had been chaste before out of deference to Christ and fidelity to Christ are now sexually active and maybe feeling bad about it, maybe not because they're trying to rationalize it, possibly even losing their own convictions about Christianity because now none of their friends think that way and they all seem to be nice people. From her perspective. So you might want to get the podcast and play this for your group. I don't know. That's up to you. But I hope
I've already subscribed a long time ago, so it will be played again. So.
All right. Joey, thanks so much for the call, and God's best to you as you talk to your friend.
Thank you, Greg.
Sure. Bye-bye now. That is a, unfortunately, all too often, too frequently, tragic of a situation. All right, more calls in just a moment. I'm Greg Kokel. The show is Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel.
You want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians just like you to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. Basic training for your mind, that's what you get here at Stand to Reason. Greg Copel, your host, 1-800-227-5278, and just talking with the enforcer about the new movie Appaloosa, which I haven't seen yet, but I told her I'm looking forward to it. It's gotten some good reviews. The cast looks sensational. Ed Harris, Vig Mortgenstein? You know, the guy from Lord of the Rings, the king guy. Anyway, I really love westerns, and I'm looking forward to seeing this one. So all reviews so far have been good. But I love it when the good guys beat the bad guys, and I think that's what happens here. Let's go back to the phones, and in Pasadena, Greg. How you doing,
hey,
Greg? This is Greg.
How are you, Greg?
All right, Greg. How are you, Greg?
Very well, thank you. Question. My wife and I have been married for 16 years. Prior to that, she was married and divorced several years before I came along. Her ex went on to remarry at least once or twice since.
Hmm.
And I've recently been doing a biblical search on divorce and remarriage,
mm-hmm.
and I've come up with a wide variety of opinion. At the extreme conservative end, it says that the relationship I'm in now is an ongoing act of adultery, and the only thing I can do to repent of it is to sin no more,
mm-hmm.
A.K.A. leave, you know, separate from my wife.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read probably 15 or 20 very scholarly papers on this, and, you know, they cover a range of, you know, acknowledge your sin and continue on in this marriage to, you know, you must separate. What do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, this is one of the most difficult questions to deal with, partly because you have these strange circumstances in the scripture or these statements that in some cases seem to be very restrictive, and then you have other things that where there seem to be exceptions to the rule, as it were. And you also have a society that is very much in one direction, and so it's the temptation is to read the scriptures in a much more liberal sense because the rest of the culture is that way. It strikes me as odd, though, when if you are told, for example, that if you marry someone who is not if you have been married and you get divorced and then you remarry, that you must now get divorced again. Because it seems to me under those circumstances, you compound the error. You are having a second divorce.
Yeah, the websites that I read that advocated that, they had a response to that, which I couldn't do justice to off the top of my head.
Well, I'd be curious if anybody can do justice to that concern. Because if you get remarried and then you are expected now to break your marriage vows a second time, rend a family a second time, possibly make children orphans a second time, I don't know how that possibly can be the right thing to do. Now, it might have been the case in some cases of remarriage that the people in question were not free to remarry. And I think there are circumstances under which that's the case. But once a person remarries, it seems to me that's an act of sin, but not an ongoing and continuing act of sin, because now what you have is a new marriage and new relationships and a new commitment and a new vow. that I don't see any reason why someone would say you have to break this second one, unless they're saying every time you sleep together, that's committing adultery, and so you're in ongoing sin.
That's kind of how they put it. And to play devil's advocate, doesn't that almost allow you to marry someone that you really shouldn't in the biblical sense and just say, well, I'll repent later?
Well, that's
kind
true.
Like,
but that's true.
Kind of like, you know, I'll park in a no parking zone and I'll pay the ticket.
I understand that, but that may be true, but that's true of any sin. If grace is available to us in the way that I think the Scripture speaks, that our sins and transgressions God remembers no more, it certainly is possible to take ill advantage of that. It's not right to do that, but when you take advantage of grace, grace doesn't disappear.
True.
You and I take advantage of grace all the time, virtually every single time we sin, knowingly and willfully.
And the response to that, again, was Onesimus had to return to his master, and I forget the tax collector who was stealing. He returned fourfold what he had stolen.
Yeah,
you know,
but
you don't get to keep the car.
Yes, that's because there is no ethical dilemma involved in restoring the original situation. In this circumstance, however, there is an ethical dilemma, and that is the severing of a second marriage vow and severing a family and putting children at risk in so doing. So since that is now the case, you have an ethical dilemma. That is, you have obligations going in two directions and a potential harm with regards to each direction, and so you have to choose the more weighty good. I don't believe that one is required, even if somebody gets remarried when they shouldn't have, that they are now required to undo that and kind of go back to the way things were. By the way, you know, sometimes it is what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7 is that a man should be particularly Christian men, should be reconciled to their wives. But if the wife remarries, or the one of the spouses remarries, what are you to do? You cannot now be reconciled because now they are in a marriage with someone else.
Right, and Deuteronomy 24:1 says that a spouse cannot return to their former spouse when there's an intervening marriage. I've become a minor expert in all
yes,
these verses
uh-huh.
and all my reading of
right.
this.
Well, you probably know more about this than I do. I think that the claim that you have to now sever your existing marriage is bizarre. It's just bizarre. It might have been the case that you were not free to remarry, or your wife wasn't free to remarry under the circumstances that you faced originally. I don't know about that, but now that you are married, now you have an existing commitment and an existing pledge and an existing vow before God.
On the general category of divorce and remarriage, do you think divorce and remarriage is biblically permissible?
Yes.
Or do you think that, you know, if you do it in sin and you got to deal with that sin and then
well,
deal with what you got,
I think it's biblical. I think there are times when remarriage is permissible and there are times when it's not. And when it's not permissible and you do get remarried, then you've done something wrong, but it's not the unforgivable sin. And what you do is you pick up from there and go on. This is, you know what this reminds me of? Here's a parallel for you. Premarital sex is wrong. Okay? So when you have premarital sex and you get pregnant, you confess the sin and abort the child. That's what this sounds like to me.
Yeah, I've heard that come up to in my reading.
This to me is kind of parallel. What you don't, you confess the sin. If you get pregnant, you confess the sin, and then you deal with the circumstances in the way that's right for the circumstances you're facing. You don't try to undo everything and add more grievance to the situation by aborting the child. Instead, you pick up where you left off, and you take responsibility, and you move forward, thankful for the grace of God. And by the same token, when you get married, remarried, and maybe you weren't at liberty too, I think you're in. I don't know in your circumstances, but if you weren't at liberty then and you did, then you deal with that before the Lord and you move on from where you're at right now and you make the best by keeping the moral obligations you're facing at the moment that are the result of having done the wrong thing. Just like the baby is the result of the pregnancy is the result of having done the wrong thing, premarital sex. You start from here and you move forward.
So, in your opinion, if I meet a divorced lady whose husband has gone on to remarry at least twice by the time I met her, was she in fact free to marry?
Well,
you don't have enough.
What God wants is he wants marriages to stay together. And if marriages are broken asunder, he wants them to be restored. Now, if you face a circumstance where it is impossible to restore the marriage, for example, in the case of death of a spouse, that's a broken – well, now you're free. You're no longer obliged to that because it's impossible to restore that marriage, okay? If the person marries someone else
– here's something to think about.
Sorry about that. If someone marries someone else, that person has then broken the sexual, you could say they've committed adultery with somebody else, and then that is an exception for your marriage obligations to her. So if they marry somebody else, that means they're sleeping with somebody else, and if they're sleeping with somebody else, that's unchastity with regards to the first relationship. And if unchastity is an exception to the marriage vow, then you are free under those terms, it seems to me, to remarry. But also the person who is being unchaste with the new man in this case is also married to the new man. And so therefore they're not going to get married back to you because they're already married. And they should acknowledge and keep that marriage vow. And so I think for that reason also you would be free to remarry under those circumstances. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, and I'm not trying to be flippant here or act like there's no, trickiness to these issues. There are. And my view is, with regards to marriage, you have a one-way ticket. And that is, you get married and that's it. We each have one chance to make a good decision. We make the good decision. And if we make the decision and it isn't good, that we don't have the liberty to walk. We are obliged before God to make it work. And I think
it's like you have one bite at the apple, and if you mess it, you're screwed for life.
Well, I don't look at it that way. You're obliged. Pardon me?
That's the hard way of looking at it.
Well, that's one way of looking at it. And if you do look at it that way, then you'll probably be miserable for life if you don't get a divorce. But that's not the way I look at it. What I tell people is, did you make vows when you got married? Yes. They said, well, then keep your vows. Oh, you mean I got to stay married? I said, no, keep your vows. Only one part of your vows was to stay married. The other part was to have and to hold, to cherish, to love in sickness and in health, for richer or poorer, until death do you part. The until death do you part is only one part of the vow. You keep the other things. Now, I think if one side of the relationship would focus in on keeping their vows, which they're obliged to do in my view, then that will have a salutary effect on the relationship. And if both are of that mind, even when things are really difficult, it's possible that the season will pass and things will get better because you realize this is the only show in town. This is all you've got. It's your only chance. You better make the best of it. Now, if you want to be screwed for the rest of your life, if you want to put it that way, that's a way of looking at it, and now you can be miserable forever. But if you think, wait a minute, I made a commitment, I made a vow, I better make this better or I'll feel screwed the rest of my life, then you're motivated to do something about it, it seems to me. And that can be a powerful motivation in the hearts of people with goodwill. Now, I don't believe that we can always fix this on our own. In fact, I think most of the times in troubled marriages, we need someone else. We need a counselor. We need somebody who's skilled at seeing the circumstances and understanding the dynamics and then helping give feedback so that people can see things that they couldn't have seen without the other person's help. The two parties involved both have their own issues at stake. They have families of origin. Feelings are involved. All kinds of stuff goes goofy when they try to solve it themselves. And this is why I am a huge proponent of having counselors that can help work through those things so that you can actually, in fact, keep the vows that you made when you got married.
Sounds good.
All right. I appreciate your call, Greg, in Pasadena. And this I understand marriage is hard. I'm married. Everybody who's married understands marriage is hard. But one of the things that makes it harder is if we don't think in terms of the permanence of the relationship. If we think in terms of permanence, ladies and gentlemen, then if we're smart, we commit ourselves to do the things that are necessary to make this the best relationship of our life instead of a relationship in our life where we have to think of ourselves as simply being screwed, as the caller put it. It's our choice largely. Now, I understand that we can't always control what the other person does, but we can control what we do, and that could go a long way to making things better for both. Anyway, chew on that. We have another hour in front of us, so stay tuned here on Stand to Reason. All right, back at you with hour number two here at Stand to Reason. Greg Kokel, your host. I'm with you every Sunday from 3 until 5. And that would be Los Angeles time. For those listening on podcast, of course, you can always call in, and we have people calling from around the country. Outside of our broadcast footprint here in Southern California, five counties, I think, here. But many callers from outside, and you're listening on podcast, and so if you want to call, you can dial 1-800-227-5278 during our live show times. Of course, I'd be glad to talk to you about anything that's on your mind in the broad area of ethics and values and religion. If you're local to me, you can dial 714, area code number 754-4150. I started last hour talking about Prop 8, which is the proposition in California that we'll be voting on now in less than a month. That is an attempt to amend the state constitution to make it clear that marriage, as far as the state is concerned, is an institution that is between a man and a woman. Now, we have domestic partnerships here in this state, and those domestic partnerships already have the same rights, protections, and benefits, according to California statute, as heterosexual relationships. And so, really, the fight here is about a word. And I spoke last hour about why I thought that fight was worthwhile, at least making one point. There are a lot of other reasons why, and they have to do with how the culture in general treats heterosexual relationships. I mean, it's already happening now in Massachusetts that children in schools there are being taught, according to judicial edict now, because they have same-sex marriage there in that state, they were the first, that there is no difference between same-sex relationships and heterosexual relationships. This is part of the fallout. So you can't make distinctions of any kind. You can't say one is better than the other. And insofar as you promote one, you have to promote the other. And that's what's happening. And this is the way kids are being educated in the public school system. And who knows what ramifications that's going to have for the private system. I know in Massachusetts, the Roman Catholic Church has already gotten out of the adoption business in that state. They had been the number one provider of adoption services in the state of Massachusetts and now have bowed out. They no longer are involved in adoptions there in that state because by law, based on same-sex marriage rulings, there can be no distinctions between heterosexual marriage and same-sex marriage, and therefore there cannot be any restrictions on adoption. And so according to law now in Massachusetts, There is no distinction between mothers and fathers. Children don't need a mom and a dad. They just need two loving people. Or three or four or more, it seems. Why not? And in fact, in California, just, let's see, where is that piece? Last month, couple fight California's gender-neutral language in wedding license. See, this was the SAC Bee, Sacramento Bee, in September 16th. So it's not even a month ago. Last month, I'm reading now, Rachel Bird exchanged vows with Gideon Cotting in a church wedding in front of family and friends. As far as Bird is concerned, she is a bride. To the state of California, however, she is either Party A or Party B. I'm not making this up, friends. Those are the terms that have replaced bride and groom on the state's new gender-neutral marriage licenses. And to Bird and Cotting, that is unacceptable. We are traditionalists. We just want to be called bride and groom, said Bird, 25, who works part-time at her father's church. Those words have been used for generations, and now they just changed them. In May, the article continues, after the California State Supreme Court ruled same-sex marriage legal, the courts mandated state officials to provide gender-neutral licenses and other marriage forms. Bride and groom became Party A and Party B. I now pronounce you Party A and Party B. That's not a wedding. It's a merger, ladies and gentlemen. Continuing, Bird and Cotting have refused to complete the new forms, a stand that has already cost them. Okay, this is a guy and a gal that get married. They refuse to complete the new forms. So what's the upshot? Because their marriage is not registered with the state, Bird cannot sign up for Cotting's medical benefits or legally take his name. Those who support same-sex marriage say it has no impact on heterosexuals, said Brad Dacus of, or that might be Dacus of the Pacific Justice Institute. This debunks that argument. I can understand their frustration, said Gloria Coutts, assistant county clerk for Placer County, but their marriage is not registered with the state. So they didn't fill out the right form. That sounds to me like a Monty Python skit. They're not married. This is just one of the spin-off results. So there are a lot of consequences to the word marriage. And as I mentioned last hour, I've kind of changed my mind a little bit about this. Even if all the rights are given away through domestic partnerships, still the word is significant. And I explained why. I want to now say something about how you argue for this in the public square. I spoke, was it last fall, I think, in Washington, D.C., at an organization called Faith and Law. These are what used to be called Hill Rats. You know, these are people who work for congressmen and senators and pretty much the people who run the business of government behind the scenes. And this was a Christian group that meets on a regular basis, I think weekly, to encourage each other, have a speaker, and knock ideas of policy and Christianity around, Faith and Law. And so I was asked to speak on the issue of same-sex marriage. And I mentioned to them that as Christians informed by – I said that there's a problem with any organization with a name like – Faith and Law. And the problem is that as a Christian, and for us as a group Christians, they're informed by Scripture, we do not want to see something that God calls a moral harm actually encouraged and honored by the laws of the land. And here I'm speaking specifically of homosexuality. But of course, there's a problem with this approach if we are in public service and speaking to a public that is not well-versed in Scripture or maybe doesn't care. The Bible is not is an appropriate grounds of informing Christians about policy, but is not generally an effective way to appeal to others about policy in the public square. Since this is not a theocracy, but rather a representative republic. Our mere Christian convictions cannot be the basis of, or I think, justification for our policy. And I also think it's tactically inept, as in a post-Christian culture, as people are not persuaded by this by and large. Now, I have a solution, and it's based on a certain insight. And it's an insight that I gained from Dr. Francis Schaeffer. And the insight simply is this, that man is made in the image of God, as a matter of fact. And people have to live in the world that God made, as a matter of fact. And so there are going to be ways in which even people who are not informed by the Bible are going to brush up against truth consistent with the Bible. Now, this is something that you can count on, that if God prohibits something, he does so for a reason. And I think his reason usually has to do with human flourishing. In other words, God made us a certain way. If we operate in a way inconsistent with the way he made us, then things are going to go wrong. And if we operate consistently with the way he made us, then things go better. And even if we don't have God's specific and special word about how he made us, we can still reflect on the way we're made and divine some of the intentions. That's what Aristotle was all about when it came to ethics, by the way. In the Nicomachean Ethics, he talked about ends, what we were made for, and how the ethical life was kind of living consistently with the ends for which we were made. A simple way of putting Aristotle, I guess. And so as a follower of Christ, committed to a biblical worldview, which I think is true, that worldview, and if true, then true for others too, in the sense that they still have to live in the world as it actually is, even though they deny it. And therefore, I have something I can appeal to them. They may be denying my worldview, but something deep down inside resonates with the peculiar characteristics of a Christian worldview, that we are made for a purpose, for example, or that the universe is thick with morality that human beings uniquely participate in. And so if God then has built morality into us, such that if we follow what is right and good and true, then we flourish, we fulfill our design, if you will. If he forbids things for our own good, then if we identify the particular good that is in question here, I think this makes possible a different kind of argument than just a religious one. It could be a secular argument or rationale that is consistent with our religious point of view. And I think this kind of argument then could make sense, at least in principle, even to those who would not be interested in what you, as a follower of Christ, think that God has to say about the issue. For example, God says it's wrong to lie. But completely apart from God, I think we can readily see that the persistent habit of deception in some things among the people of a culture would rend the social fabric, so civilization would no longer be workable. Therefore, we have laws against perjury. We have laws against deception and advertising or slander or libel. And these are laws that are justified completely on a secular basis, that is, without any appeal to God, though they are consistent with God's concerns. So, this then gives us, I think, a foothold in culture. And this is what we should be looking for on a consistent basis. And the way we've always argued with regards to the homosexuality and the same-sex marriage issue, that we have our own personal convictions about what pleases God, but we also have completely secular reasons about what is good for communities of human beings, regardless of their theological convictions. And so that's why I can go into a political circumstance and argue without using the scripture, though I might, with the right group. I can argue based completely on secular reasons that I, if I do my job well, could resonate with the commitment others have to the common good. Now, of course, people aren't always committed to the common good, and in some issues, they just care about their own good, regardless of the costs to others. And there's not much you can do about that. Only God can change that heart. But people, without being regenerated, can still be persuaded to do that which is good and right for everyone, and sometimes even if it's against their own self-interest. And I think this is what we have at our disposal when we're going to argue for these kinds of things. And my approach to this issue is not religious. And in fact, it makes no reference to God, Jesus, or the Bible, and also makes no moral judgment whatsoever on homosexuality. We can argue against it without having to go there. No, we could go there if we wanted to, but our question is, at this point, what are we trying to accomplish? Are we trying to just speak the truth, regardless of whether people get mad or not? Or are we trying to get make common cause with people for good reasons for the betterment of the culture? And generally, when we're dealing with policy issues, that's the case. And then what matters is that they agree with us, not that they agree with us for the reasons that we hold our views. All right, so pack that away for future political discussion. 1-800-227-5278. Let's go to those phones. And in Fresno, Michael. Thanks for waiting, Michael.
Hi. Hey, Greg, can you hear me okay?
I sure can.
I have a cell phone headset on. I'm afraid of the radiation, so.
Well, it sounds perfect.
Hey, thanks.
So far.
Yeah, I'm actually new to California. I've only been here for about a month. Mm-hmm. I'm from Canada, and we had this whole gay marriage issue thing.
Same-sex marriage. There's a difference.
Well, yeah, same-sex, gay, yeah. But, sorry.
Gays can already get married. They just can't marry the same sex. This issue is not whether gays can marry. It's whether same sexes can marry.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Words are important in this one.
Yeah, well, hey, good luck to you folks for that because, you know, after the same-sex marriage thing went through in Canada, that people pretty much just didn't want to hear about it anymore, even the opponents of it. So it's a hard battle to fight when a judge makes a decision like that.
Yeah, of course. And this is why we go to the people right now and we have an initiative process where we can amend the Constitution, and other states have done this. But that's what you have to do in order to do something commonsensible, it seems to me. Anyway, what's on your mind?
Last week you were asking about social justice. In fact, you kind of posed a question. It sounded like you were throwing it out to the audience. You just said you'd really like to know where people get their definition of social justice.
Yeah, it was somewhat of a rhetorical question, but I'd be glad to, because I have an opinion about what that phrase means, but I'd be glad to let you weigh in on it.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm not an expert. I'm just actually learning about this myself.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I didn't grow up with this tradition, and so I'm just kind of learning. But I think more than the acts account, where the people there are living out the law of God just naturally, I'd say probably on social justice, Amos would probably speak to it the most out of any book in terms of what it means to be just, especially in the way that Amos ties the words righteousness and justice together throughout his book. And I mean, I'd say maybe Amos chapter 5 mostly.
All right. Well, certainly that Israel was guilty of injustice of many sorts.
Yeah. Now, the reason why I bring up Amos 5 is because the injustice in that sense was oppression of the poor.
Yes.
And so, sorry, if I can just break off my little lecture here. What do you make of the Jubilee law and the, you know, having people not stretch the corners of their field and that kind of stuff in the Old Testament? Because there were some instances there where, you know, someone owned a field.
No, I know what the concept is.
Yeah.
The Jubilee law was that the land got returned to its original owners.
That's
after,
right.
I think, 70 years, whatever it was, the year of Jubilee. And the real question is, it's ironic that, not that you're doing this, but that this comes up with some people who are deeply offended when you mention, say, the Levitical law against homosexuality.
Yeah.
And they are deeply offended by that because they say, well, this of course, doesn't apply to us now. And there is a sense in which they're right. That is, the Levitical law itself, which talks about not only prohibitions but punishments for breaking the law, I don't think apply to us now in that case. Even though I think homosexuality is still immoral, we don't adjudicate against homosexuality in that way because we are Gentiles, not under the Levitical law. Israel was.
Can I interrupt just for a second?
No. Okay. You can in just a few seconds.
Sure.
I want to finish the thought. Actually, I'll make the thought, then I'll go to break, and then I'll come back to you.
Sure.
But the Levitical law is for the Jews. Now, we learn things from the Levitical law about what might be good and true and wise and that kind of thing, but it is a law for the Jews and not for the Gentiles. And so we can't just willy-nilly invoke things like the year of Jubilee or the like, as if those are the same. They're the same moral obligations on us that they were on the covenant people of God. So let me come back to you in a minute. I want to hear what you have to say, and we'll talk a little bit more about this notion of social justice. I'll put you on hold. Greg Kokel, at Stand to Reason. I'll be back in just a moment.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
I have a suggestion for you. Pick up the phone and dial 1-800-2-REASON. That's Stand to Reason's toll-free number. Ask us to send you solid ground, then leave your name and address. It's that simple. Let me tell you what this is for. If you call us, we're going to send you our bi-monthly publication, Solid Ground, free for a year. This is no ordinary newsletter. You'll receive practical, concise, useful tools to be an ambassador for Christ. In Solid Ground, Greg Kokel will help you deal with issues like abortion, evolution, cloning, homosexuality, doctor-assisted suicide, something timely so you're not caught by surprise and embarrassed when you want to stand up as an ambassador on key issues you will be challenged on. So call us right now at 1-800-2-REASON and ask for Solid Ground. We'll send it to you absolutely free. Or go to our website at str.org and ask for Solid Ground. While you're at it, you can download some of the over 300 free reports you'll also find there. That's 1-800-2-REASON and on the web, str.org.
The show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm Greg Kokel, your host. Talking a little bit right now about social justice, and the caller is Michael in Fresno. And Mike, I talked just a little bit about, you made reference to Amos. Actually, I just read the entire chapter during the break, so I have a little familiarity. Mostly Amos 5 is God's really mad. But then he talks about some of the things that make him mad, and some of that is distressing the righteous, accepting bribes, and also turning aside the poor at the gate, okay? So this is an issue that you brought up in the context of social justice. So I wanted to give you a chance to respond. You said you had something that you wanted to say just a moment ago.
Yeah, actually, I just wanted to grab a pen because you gave me a lot of stuff there, and I was losing track. But I totally agree with you in the way that Levitical law, like, we don't just take that and apply it as a legal system today. I mean,
right.
We're reading something that's pretty old. But
right.
I again agree with you that we take those principles and learn from them and apply them. And what I want to challenge you with is to look through the minor prophets, especially Amos, but have the minor prophets inform your definition of justice, because what I hear from you is that your definition of justice it has a real penal sound to it, you know, like a legal sound, where the minor prophets talk about justice in terms of things being right. And if you ask anyone out there, and just to appeal to a common moral sensibility, is a child starving to death, is that right? And it may not be anyone's fault. I mean, the rains may have failed and the crops didn't grow, and it's nobody's fault except, it's just nature. And the child starves. Is that right? And I, I'd, I'd be hard to think. It would be difficult to find anyone who'd say, "Yeah, that's okay." You know.
Yeah. Now, well, I agree with you entirely on that, Michael. Okay. Now, what's the solution?
Well, you see, here's the thing. I'm sorry. I'm working on a definition of social justice here.
Well, I know what you want to define social justice as doing that what is right. Okay, and that isn't the way the word just. Well, the word justice means justice. It's not just doing what is right, because for me to be kind to you doesn't. It would be an act of charity or kindness or virtue. But it doesn't mean that you have been treated unjustly if I don't go out of my way to do something nice for you.
And that's where I disagree with you, Greg. And where I'm getting that from is not just, I haven't done a lot of reading on this quite yet, and I'm looking forward to it. But in the Minor Prophets, there's this suggestion, because we are all together and integrated, and the individualism that we live in right now is something that's foreign to the Old Testament.
I'm not promoting individualism. What I'm saying is that first of all, there is no act of injustice that is done when we don't do something charitable for somebody else. Charitable is charity. It isn't an entitlement, and this is what this concept of social justice has become. When there are poor people, the people are poor because of injustice, and we must correct the injustice by giving something to them, but the only way we give to them is by taking it from someone else.
Okay,
so the government is the ones that are generally in social justice. It is a government program of redistribution of wealth, and that is not charity or justice. It is theft.
Okay, that's an upper level of the argument in terms of what the U.S. government does. But on the lower end, in terms of, is it just to withhold your money when someone else is in need? No, it's not. And the reason is the world isn't fair. Like, we're not all on a level playing field.
No, describe need. Define need for me, Michael.
I'm sorry?
What is need?
Can we just break it down to hunger, like not having enough food at the end of the day?
There's almost nobody in this country that doesn't have enough food at the end of the day. Almost nobody.
So would you disagree then with taxation being sent to international aid?
Pardon me?
If the government wanted to tax the rich and send the money overseas...
Why should they tax the rich?
No, I'm making it easy for you here, Greg.
Well, to me, it's very easy. I think that we have an obligation as human beings to help the poor. There are some people that are, in a sense, deserving poor, and there are some people that aren't. And the New Testament makes a distinction. If a man does not work, he should not eat. And that this concept is repeated a number of times in the New Testament. So there are times that people have genuine need, and we are obliged as human beings and individuals to help those people out as an act of charity, but not as an act of justice. It isn't an entitlement that they have, and they are being treated unjustly if they don't receive it. And in either case, though, it's not forced redistribution of wealth by the government, by their own ideas of who is poverty stricken and who isn't, and by their own ideas of who has too much and who doesn't. Instead, you have, like in the New Testament, where people who had excess because they worked hard for it gave out of their own goodwill to help others that didn't. And that's the kind of thing that I promote.
Yeah.
And that's what we should be doing, and in fact, that's the way my wife and I live our lives.
I think we agree on a lot of stuff, and like you said, that those who are in surplus are obliged, you know. But it's not a matter of taking by force. But I guess the real operative question here, because I think what's happening is a whole bunch of different terms are getting muddled into the same pool. But if we could just say this, is that to what extent do we as Christians make our convictions part of the governmental system, okay?
And virtually zero.
Greg. I mean,
when you're talking about this kind of thing of redistribution of wealth, virtually zero. Because the government, I should decide who I give my money to. That's what the New Testament teaches. It doesn't teach that Caesar comes in and ought to take away and give to whoever he thinks is best. That's theft. For use in this purpose. Government doesn't have that purpose, not Gentile governments. It's for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of those who do right. That's the biblical purpose of government. The Old Testament had a little bit different system because it was a theocracy. But even in that case, the government didn't redistribute the wealth. The people were supposed to help the poor.
I'm sorry, but the people were, if people threshed to the end of their fields, that was breaking the law.
Right. Okay. So that there's gleaning. In other words, the people who then you, and actually this is a great example because the people who did get what was left had to work for it. It wasn't handed to them. They went out and gleaned.
Yeah.
Okay. So that people had an opportunity to work for themselves. Nothing was given to them out of, you know, just, you know, as a redistribution.
No, I mean, that was on that person's land. And so that person planted the seed, tended the crop.
I understand.
And then I'm sorry?
No, I understand entirely.
Yeah, and so it's not as if the thing is that it wasn't charity in the way that, you know, they could decide to not give it to those people who didn't have food. The law was there to allow them to glean.
That's right. That was the – okay, but that was a restriction that was made on the people of Israel. Now the people of God have a similar obligation. The church is to help the poor, not the government.
I got to finish my thought.
All right.
So the whole thing with the gleaning, though, comes from an understanding that the rain is going to fall on certain areas and not others, and it's nobody's fault. But the thing is – see, even when that happens, the rain falls on one person's field, it doesn't fall on the other.
Uh-huh.
The person who has the surplus, the person who has his crops growing, has not only an obligation, but, and this is, I know this isn't a Levitical system, but I'm saying this is a principle that that we could easily use today to say that, no, they are obliged with a capital O to share their surplus, and if they don't, that's being unjust.
Okay.
Now, as far as how that works out, in terms of taxation and welfare, you know, I'm at a loss. I'm not a political guy.
Uh-huh.
But all I'm saying is that when a Christian goes out and enables people in poverty to work and does those sorts of things, we can't call it charity. We have to call it justice because that's...
No, at that point, I disagree entirely in terms of the use of the word justice.
Well, I'm just getting it from the Minor Prophets, Greg, but but listen... you know what?
Well, that's not exactly true. Pardon me?
I think we're both on the same
The term, the term social justice is a leftist term that justifies social engineering, which includes, among other things, the redistribution of wealth from those who made it to those who didn't, based on leftist standards, not based on biblical standards. If biblical standards were in play, that would be something entirely different. But they are not. The New Testament standard doesn't make anything of this. It says we should help the poor. It doesn't make the doesn't make the argument that people who are poor, and by the way, I'm not even sure what that term means now because the word poverty and poor has been so politicized. But if there are people who have are poor and they have genuine need, you don't need a government agency to redistribute. In that situation, opportunity was made available to people so that people could take the initiative and do the work themselves. It wasn't just given to them willy-nilly off the backs of somebody else. So I see some similarities with what you're saying and the circumstances now, but the way things are distributed are completely different. And what ends up happening now is not something good for people who are so-called poor, but something bad for them. There are very, very clear restrictions in the New Testament which supersede or at least clarify the obligations that are generally communicated in the Old Testament that have to do with giving. And if a person does not provide for his own family, Paul says he's worse than an unbeliever.
Yeah.
That you only give to widows, for example, who are widows indeed. In other words, who don't have family members that are helping them. They're all by themselves. And only after they have helped and been faithful in the church and those kinds of things. He makes those qualifications very clear. So I don't think it's reasonable or fair to just jump back to Amos and cite a couple passages as justification for some larger scheme of redistribution, which you haven't pushed for specifically, but you continue to use the language of those people who do that very thing.
You see, I really haven't even read any leftist material, and that's kind of why I said at the beginning, is because I'm at the beginning of thinking.
No, that's not what I meant. I was referring to the term social justice, and that's
okay.
A term that is definitely leftist in its meaning and its application. Is there an obligation that you and I have to the poor? The answer is yes, and we are. But that obligation is tempered in some measure by the New Testament teachings. My wife and I are, you know, take that obligation seriously, and all Christians ought to. part of the problem, though, with the government is when the government starts taking that responsibility on themselves, there's no accountability. There is a tremendous amount of waste. There is no one to say thank you to. And the people who end up getting it start seeing it not as a gift but as an entitlement. And that ends up poisoning the very people it's meant to help. And the history especially since the mid-60s and the so-called Great Society of LBJ is evidence that that's exactly what happens.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'd say that what you're talking about goes right to the very end of the specifics of writing the checks and sending them in the mail and the taxation, all the way back to the actual principle. And I think maybe there's a bit of muddling in terms of the ideas, the practice, and how it actually takes shape in the government.
Do you think the New Testament teaches that the government should be involved when whatever is taught about giving in the New Testament? Is the expectation there that the government should take it away from unwilling people and give it to the people that the government deems are deserving?
Now, Greg, you know the New Testament isn't a textbook on government.
Well, it has quite a bit to say about it, and it has quite a bit to say about giving. One could argue that the Old Testament is not a textbook on government either, even though it has things to say about both of those.
Yeah, I would agree with both things. Now, as far as does the New Testament tell us to the question you just asked, I'm not going to repeat it, but no, it doesn't.
Well, it doesn't give any indication that that's the way the problem should be dealt with. It gives a different indication about how the problem of the poor should be dealt with, not redistribution of wealth by Gentile governments. They
yeah,
can't be
now,
trusted.
Of course it doesn't say that, but the thing is that if there's a – see, we agree on a main point, which is people who have who have more than they need. And I know you're saying that poverty and need, these are loaded terms. So,
well, of course, and you have more than you need. Everybody in this country, everybody virtually – I mean, there are exceptions to every rule, but as a rule, everybody in this country has way more – than they need.
Yeah, especially Christians. And if Christians were the first ones to...
Well, I don't know why Christians in particular have more others, but...
What I'm saying is if Christians took the first step and actually, gave more money...
Michael, you have not been paying attention. Christians have been giving for millennia, and especially in this country at this time, Christians are giving like crazy.
You heard a criticism that wasn't there.
Okay.
But anyway, all I'm saying is that if there's a principle that we understand, what's to say? And even though the New Testament doesn't talk about redistribution of wealth, and you know what, I'm not.
Well, it does do that, but it talks about charitable giving. It doesn't talk about forced redistribution. That's
yeah.
the point I'm making. It isn't silent. It's silent about the means that most people have in mind when they mention social justice.
Well,
it does talk about redistribution of wealth, but it's charitable. That means it's done out of love and kindness and done as a free will gift.
Yeah, but it doesn't – you can't argue from silence about what it
– I'm not arguing from silence.
Greg, you are, because it doesn't talk about what the government's supposed to do. And so you're saying that because it says you're supposed to give out of love, that by nature is saying that the government should be left out of it.
We could talk all day long about this, Michael, but
yeah.
I think we've covered as much ground as we're going to cover now, and you can have the last word.
Greg, it's been good talking to you.
Thank you. It's nice talking to you, Mike, in Fresno.
Hey, Greg.
Pardon me?
I'm just going to give a happy Thanksgiving to all the Canadians up there listening.
Thank you, and the best to you as well. Bye, Michael. All right, coming up, break, and then more calls on Stand to Reason.
We are ambassadors for Christ. That's what Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians 5:20. An effective ambassador has three essential skills. First, an ambassador must have the basic knowledge necessary for his task. Second, this knowledge must be deployed in a skillful way. There's an element of wisdom, a tactical and artful diplomacy that makes his message persuasive. Third is character. His personal maturity and individual virtue will either make or break his message. Stand to Reason's mission is to help you develop the foundational skills in each one of these areas. In Essential Ambassador Skills, Greg Kokel will train you in all three of these areas to be an effective ambassador for Christ and to represent God's message of grace in a broken world. To order this unique message, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. 800-2-REASON or str.org to order Essential Ambassador Skills by Greg Kokel.
Hi, I'm Greg Kokel. Do you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about? Well, Stand to Reason can help you do just that. We train Christians, just like you, to be effective ambassadors for Christ. But we rely on the support of listeners to continue broadcasting on the air and on the web. Your gift keeps STR providing training to you and other Christians to become effective ambassadors for Jesus Christ. You'll learn how to deliver a message that's accurately informed, develop a method that is skillful, tactical, and fair, and cultivate a character that is warm, attractive, and inviting. If you want to make a difference for Christianity worth thinking about today, both in the world and in the church, consider supporting Stand to Reason Radio. You can start supporting STR today by calling 1-800, the number 2 and the word reason, or donate securely online at str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON. All right, back at you here at Stand to Reason. And just a point of clarification here. I don't want to get into the issue itself because Michael and I talk at length about the issue of social justice, and you all can draw your own conclusions about Amos and the rest. But just a clarification regarding an argument from silence. It is not an argument from silence that you fail to affirm something that the Bible doesn't affirm. That is, it isn't an argument from silence in the pejorative, as if you're doing something wrong. All right? When I say the Bible doesn't teach that we have to do this, then it seems to me we're not obliged to do that. Because if we are obliged, we have to then show the obligation stated in the Scripture in the way that you're advancing it. And since it doesn't, then we're not obliged. Well, at least that's my point. And it doesn't fail in virtue of an argument from silence. It is an argument from silence when you say we have an obligation that isn't mentioned. That it's there, but it isn't mentioned. So that's the affirmation in the midst of silence regarding your point. So I wasn't guilty of that. Whatever you think of the argument proper that we were discussing, mine wasn't guilty of argument from silence. All right, let's go to Grand Rapids, Minnesota. And is it Ramey?
Yes.
Ramey, I always want to think of Grand Rapids, Michigan, and then I see there's double N's there. That's Minnesota.
That's right. A lot of people make that mistake.
Yeah, glad to have you. We've talked before, haven't we?
Well, actually, I was on the cruise with my wife and my extended family.
I guess we have then.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Okay, Ramey, of course. Now it makes sense. Now I'm putting them all together here. Nice to talk to you again, Ramey.
Good to talk to you.
Yeah, you had like the whole family.
Yeah.
Like, your brothers and all the tall ones, right?
That's right.
Okay, good to talk to you again.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, I wanted to give you my wife's greetings as well.
Great.
Natalie. And I wanted to say we really have enjoyed and used your ministry tremendously for different things.
Mm-hmm.
Right now we are teaching a senior high Sunday school and on apologetics.
Good for you.
And we have a small group that meets, and we're talking about apologetics too in that.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in that context, we've kind of been talking about some of your ideas as far as being a good ambassador.
Mm-hmm.
And we had an opportunity, my wife and I, this past week to put some of that into practice. We were at a conference for my professional societies. Mm-hmm. And
are you in medical profession?
No, I'm actually in agricultural research.
Okay.
But we were meeting jointly with geologists.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were some interesting papers on teaching evolution in both public schools and in university settings.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a poster that caught my eye that talked about intelligent design creationism as a danger to science education.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife and I decided we should swallowed hard and decided we should engage this person at his poster and talk to him a little bit mm-hmm. about some of his ideas.
So is this a one-on-one conversation, or was he speaking and you were part of the audience?
No, a poster session is more informal, where they stand by a poster presentation of their results. and talk about their ideas, and you can just talk to them one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
Usually maybe one or two people also are listening in, so it's pretty large, like a convention area. But at any rate, he we got to talking and talked about some about God, and I mentioned there were some evidences for God, and got to the idea of the cosmological argument,
right,
that the universe had a beginning, and therefore something had to bring it into existence.
Mm-hmm. That's outside of the universe itself, right?
Right. And his comment was, well, who created God? That kind of new atheist argument.
Uh-huh.
But
all right.
Yeah, but at any rate, I said, well, you're basically faced with two possibilities. Either something had to exist eternally. Either it was the universe or previous universes, which he was kind of believing, or God.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, he basically said, you know, I've had enough. This conversation is over.
Mm-hmm.
And so we moved on to other things.
Yeah.
But he then invited us to a public forum that was going to be taking place that evening about evidences.
Ramey, could you speak up just a little bit? We're having a hard time on this end.
Okay.
Move a little closer to that phone.
All right. He was talking about a forum that was taking place that evening on evidences for evolution.
Right.
And so we went to that forum, but I got to thinking about that forum and other forums that I've been to, public presentations, where people offer an argument, and unless you're somebody of your caliber who has kind of can engage them in a side-by-side debate,
right,
people in the audience don't really get much of a chance to ask a question.
Mm-hmm.
You may get one shot at it, maybe,
right,
maybe two. And so I'm wondering, from a tactical perspective, what kind of advice or suggestions do you have for engaging people, not so much in one-on-one, but in those kind of public forums,
right,
where you're just part of the audience?
Well, that's a tough question, because it depends on so many other things. I'm thinking to myself, when I go to events like that, am I inclined to speak up or be silent? And if I do speak up, what kind of thing am I trying to accomplish? And I guess you have to ask yourself first, what are you trying to accomplish? Are you trying to stump the speaker? I'm not talking about you in particular, Ramey, because I know that this probably isn't your motivation. Some people want to stump the speaker. There are Christians who want to get up and kind of show how much they know and try to embarrass the speaker, or kind of get in a little verbal fisticuffs, even though they're never going to kind of change that person's mind. This is part of being faithful to Christ in their mind, the standing up. And so there's a mixture there sometimes of maybe misdirected zeal, like, I've got to say something in order to be faithful to Christ. And then then it becomes off-putting in a way that is not good for the gospel. Or it's and I'm speaking more to other listeners now, it's just a kind of a religious justification for being obnoxious, you know. And I think in those circumstances, it's better just to say nothing. You might find a rare circumstance, though, when you may be able to ask a well-placed question that could make your point. And keep in mind that you are going to have – probably not going to have a chance for a rejoinder, though you might, given the circumstances. And so what your goal is – and if I were in that circumstance, I'd be trying to ask a question to try to get the audience to think. Put a stone in their shoe. So if I could ask a question that didn't sound obnoxious or inappropriately confrontive – but was cordial but incisive in the sense that it got some people thinking, then I might raise my hand and join in. For example, in the whole area of cosmology, if that's what was kind of being discussed, I would ask the question, is it, Professor, do you think it is more reasonable to believe that the universe came from nothing with no cause, or came from, and when I say the universe, I'm meaning everything that exists, but I guess some might want to say, well, the universe is outside of ours, but we have no evidence of that.
Right.
Our universe came from, came out of nothing, or that it was designed by an intelligent person outside of the natural realm. And why? So do you think it's more likely, A or B, and why? Now, I just think it's far more reasonable. Or actually, that's the question. Is it more reasonable to believe, and why? It is far more reasonable to believe that the physical universe came into being as a result of something else that is adequate to the effect. And I think you're going to need some kind of personal being for that. But if you pose the question that way, it doesn't take long, 30 seconds. And it gives them an alternative that I think showcases the concerns that we have about those kinds of responses he's likely to give. Right. I mean, people can always say, well, multi-universes or come out of nothing or quantum fluctuations or stuff like that. The real question in my mind is not what's possible, but what is most reasonable.
Right.
And then you actually don't show your hand there. I mean, you could be the guy who heard some ID guys talking, and so you're interested in this. But I think that my questions would be governed largely by the nature of the circumstances and thinking, what stone could I put in the shoe of the listeners? And if I didn't think that I could, then I probably wouldn't step up to the plate. I'm mixing my metaphors there a little bit, but if I didn't think I could connect in some way with the pitch, I wouldn't step up to the plate. I wouldn't take the chance. And right. A lot of times those kind of venues are not friendly or favorable to, a Christian kind of making a point.
Right.
But the question is the safest thing.
That's true. And, in fact, the forum we did end up going to on evolution was very large, a lot of people there, very large auditorium.
A little louder, Ramey. I'm just having a hard time. I don't know the connection. Grand Rapids, Minnesota is a long way away, you know.
Well, at that particular forum I was in, there was a lot of people there, and all the speakers who preceded the Q&A time, which we didn't actually stay for, were very hostile and ridiculing of Christian viewpoint.
Right.
So I didn't feel like it would be fruitful to try and...
Right. Now, what you might notice, though, you might also notice that, and it depends, it won't be fruitful to change the mind of the person speaking, and I'm going to have to move in onto another caller after this, but it could be fruitful to other people listening. And there's probably a lot of Christians in that audience, and people are too afraid to speak up.
Right.
So if you could say, sometimes you can use the suicide tactic, in other words, you see something amiss in the way they're thinking, and you could use a question to exploit that. And maybe that gets people going. A lot just depends on the kind of claim that they're making. And so that could be helpful, even though the person is not going to be friendly to your view. Just the fact that he has just asking the question sometimes makes the point. And so, you might want to try that. I have done that in some cases. And I had people come up to me afterwards and said, gee, I'm really glad you asked that question because I didn't know what to say to him, but that was a really good point or something like that. So using the Columbo tactic like that might benefit. Okay, Ramey?
Yeah, thank you.
All the best to your whole family.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks for the call. Let's go to, this would be Tom and San Dimas here in Southern California. Oh, Tony, I'm sorry. Tony, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I was wondering that in these economic times, I've heard so many sermons lately on how the Lord will meet all our needs and not to worry, but I can't help but worrying because I keep thinking about the Christians in the Sudan and other countries who are shackled and starving.
Right.
So I didn't know if it was just our spiritual needs or is that our physical needs too?
Yeah, I always have a difficult time with those kinds of, not only those kinds of statements, but those kinds of promises in the Scripture. It's clear that even the Apostle Paul, I mean, if you want to have a super spiritual guy, a guy who's doing everything right and crossing all his T's and dotting all his I's, spiritually speaking, I think Apostle Paul is one of those. Yet at the same time, he had all kinds of distresses,
right,
all kinds of difficulties and stuff. So I think if somebody is promising that your material needs are always going to be met, and that's somehow the promise of God, I just have difficulty with that partly because of the things that you observe,
right,
that there are a lot of people whose needs aren't being met. Now, it might be that we have to understand needs in a very spare sense. That is, in the sense that Jesus spoke of it in the Sermon on the Mount. I think in Matthew 5, he talks about the lilies of the field and the sparrows and all that other stuff. And he said, if you have clothing and food, then you should be content. And I think in terms of basic needs, we can trust in God that he is going to supply them, but most of what we think of as needs are not really needs. And this is part of my frustration in the conversation with Michael when he talked about helping the poor and the like, is that who gets to decide who is deserving poor in this country with a redistribution of wealth? And it's a lot of people that I don't think are in the best place, the position to judge that. And people talk about poverty in this country, and it turns out there's just about no one that does not, whose needs are not met in the normal social situation the way Jesus described there in Matthew 5.
Truly. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that becomes kind of a fudge word, needs or poverty or something like that. My general approach is not to expect a lot from God in that way. Like my faith is hinged on somebody bringing groceries to my doorstep tomorrow. Actually, our needs are met, and our needs are met in spades compared to most people in the world. And so, I see this as the gracious hand of God coupled with our responsible activity. And the New Testament teaches both. And so as far as others in the world, I mean, there are Christians that are in very, very dire circumstances and that are suffering terribly, and many are punished or tormented or persecuted or martyred. And that is not evidence of God abandoning them, but it's evidence, but God is there even so. We're just finishing up the Hiding Place, my wife and I, by Corrie Ten Boom, and there you have tremendous distress in her circumstances and also odd ways that God comes through in the crisis and provides for them just when they desperately need it. So oftentimes it's something like that theologically. I appreciate your question, Tony, and I think this is one of the harder ones, particularly when we are used to in our culture so much as being necessary, when that which is necessary is really quite little, probably from God's perspective. Okay, that's all the time we have for the show. Your homework this week, go to str.org. Our featured article is Developing Courage. And when you want to develop your physical strength, you can lift weights. What about weightlifting to develop courage? That's what I talk about in our featured article on the homepage of str.org. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. You go out and give them heaven this week. Bye-bye, friends.